I wish there was a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. I'm Laurie Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time and unearths the struggle of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to the page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. Later on today's show, Field Mole Desiree Helligers talks with activists and shares audio from Wednesday night's celebration of Joanne Hardesty's swearing in to the Portland City Council. And I speak with James Phillips, who challenges the corporate media's narrative about Central America by examining the U.S. role behind protests in Nicaragua and migrants fleeing Honduras. Leading off the hour, the Moles Bill Resnick and Christian Williams continued their discussion of how to confront the police, limit their authority, and also keep them from joining with the far right and its military supporters. To someday, as the country falls into economic environmental crisis, declare martial law and take over. Williams is an activist who has worked in efforts to democratize the police and has written several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Life During Wartime, Resisting Counterinsurgency. Here is Bill Resnick with Christian Williams.
Hi, Christian Williams. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello, Bill.
We're here for the second of a three-part interview on the police and how to keep them from becoming the armed force of a fascist takeover should the U.S. and planet start collapsing into a great combined economic global warming crisis, which seems likely to happen. Could be soon, could be in 50 years, because international ruling elites reject the science and just refuse to stop. In the first part, we discussed police strategies to suppress the left insurgent protest. Police before and after World War II basically used what a number of sociologists have called escalated force, but escalated force with batons and water cannons and snarling dogs as captured on TV. They gave the police a bad black eye when they used that tactic on civil rights demonstrators, so the police adapted to that. They needed a new tactic. It's called negotiated management, is what they tried to impose. But negotiated management also didn't work so good. That's because some groups refused to negotiate their rights away, like on issues like where and when they could march and demonstrate and the signage and numerous other things. The police wanted to guide them, and that was rejected. So police then adapted again with a strategy called strategic incapacitation. Strategic incapacitation also hasn't worked so well. In the second part, I begin the discussion of why it hasn't been very successful for the police. But unfortunately, it's been even worse, it seems to me, for the left. In the second part, I'm going to begin the discussion of what happened to the protest movements and police-demonstrator relations in the period of strategic incapacitation, which began right after the Battle of Seattle, basically. It began in the year 2000. So what happened after that? First, it seems to me the police kept militarizing equipment, robocops, special units, training in quick strikes, training in intimidating, training in the equipment and logistics of arresting and containing large numbers of people. All of this got funding and advice from the federal government, including the military, the FBI, consultants, and tactics and training also from the Israelis, who, of course, perfected the science of breaking up movements and making it seem that it was all in self-defense. We were under attack. A second development, of course, was the rise of the alt-right neo-fascists, who developed a strategy for dealing with the left and provoking them and, in fact, claiming somehow to be the forces of law and order, like this Proud Boy movement who inflicts themselves on Portland. They're reaching out to the police, making friends with them, portraying themselves as God-loving patriots compared to those intolerant, police-hating, violent leftists. And then the third development that's occurred after the year 2000 and our period of strategic incapacitation, there's the emergence of parts of the left, the antifas, who want to confront both the neo-fascists and the police. And these three groups come to dominate the media coverage and indeed popular memories of the events and actions, since they are striking in their outfits and theatrical and loud in their behavior. This seems to me very unfortunate and plays into the hands of the fascists and the worst elements of the police, and it becomes the most memorable part of the demonstration. Christian, do you accept that analysis, or do you propose a different perspective?
Well, those are all things that have gained a new prominence in the last handful of years, but none of those are especially new developments on their own. I mean, the process of militarization really began in the late 1960s as a direct result of the civil rights movement.
And the drug wars. They armed themselves. Tactical squads.
Yes, although Nixon's advisor, Haldeman, has been forthright, or was later forthright, in saying that the drug war was really just invented as a scheme to attack black communities. And if you look at how it's played out, the focus of the police attention has not necessarily been where the drug problem was greatest. It's just where black people were concentrated. And the effect on those communities has been completely devastating, which, of course, was the point. I actually consider the drug war part of the counterinsurgency operation, not a sort of separate apolitical development. So militarization's been underway for decades. The connection between official police agencies and unofficial right-wing forces has been that's been a long-standing relationship that really goes back all the way to the development of the Ku Klux Klan in the 19th century. The Klan, I talk about this some in Our Enemies in Blue, but it shares a common ancestor with modern police forces in the form of the slave patrol, that were these bodies of basically every adult white man had to do his turn in the South on a patrol riding between plantations enforcing the slave codes, and that practice of riding together and intimidating the black population was something that people early in the period of the Klan had already had experience with because of their experience in the slave patrols. And so there's this deep they're like cousins. There's this deep institutional genealogy that the organized racists of the non-state variety and the police share. And so there's been a tendency for collaboration. There's been a tendency for having members in common, you know, all the way back since the beginning of the institution. So the current version of this is the sort of alt-right Proud Boys stuff, but it's a new instantiation of a very old pattern. In terms of the development of militancy on the left, I mean, in general, I think people are right to resist, and they are going to inevitably resist in a variety of different ways. And sometimes that's taken the form of violent confrontation, and sometimes that takes other forms, and sometimes those tactics are well advised, and sometimes those tactics are foolish, and you know, that's just sort of how history goes. So at the moment, we're in a period where that type of action is at least grabbing the headlines, although I don't know that it is actually that much more prominent than it has been at other points. But it's not a new development. It's not anything outside of the sort of historical lineage of left-wing activity.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Christian Williams, who's been active in efforts to democratize and hold accountable the police, and wrote the book Our Enemy in Blue, Police and Power in the U.S. So, Christian, we're here for the second of a three-part interview on the police and how to keep them from becoming the armed force of a fascist takeover should the U.S. and planet start collapsing into a great combined economic and global warming crisis, which seems likely to happen, could be soon, could be in 50 years, because the internationalist ruling elites reject the science and just refuse to stop. In the first part, we discussed police strategies to suppress left insurgent protests. They've changed over the last 100 years with what's called escalated force being abandoned by the police when in the civil rights struggles that gave them and the right a black eye. So they tried what's called negotiated management, and that's when many left groups refused to negotiate their rights away. The police developed a strategy called strategic incapacitation that's now running into trouble and created, however, a very unfortunate situation in which the battles between the radical right and left antifas gave the police an excuse for breaking up and disturbing left demonstrations. In the second interview, Christian Williams was dubious about the left being able to reach out to the police to somehow influence them to stop their violence against the left. He argued that the police have a duty, and Christian Williams argued that the police have a duty, and they're organized to keep order and protect the properties, which puts them into conflict with the left and the poor, who seek a very different society as to income and power. He contends these structural factors lead to police developing right-wing values and politics. That's, of course, absolutely correct, but it ignores what's crucial. How far right do they go? Who do they affiliate with? Do they go with the outright fascists to declare martial law? Or do they remain loyal to those elites who decide to accept the popular left who may have won a plebiscite or election? In fact, the corporate right did that. Even though a lot of their properties were, in effect, nationalized, they complained a lot. They were very angry. But they basically accepted a left victory under Roosevelt. Elections were won by the left, and the Roosevelt administration came to direct the recovery of the U.S. from the Depression and also directed victory in World War II. Will the police now today see their best interests lie with continuation of a constitutionalist state, or will they see themselves somehow better off with the fascists to declare martial law when the country goes into crisis that most scientists, of course, see as happening if we don't deal with global warming and other environmental problems? And it doesn't appear to me that any of the elites in the world want to really deal with them. So no doubt there exists a structured antagonism between the left, allied with the bottom half, and the police, protecting the property and privilege of the elites. But that antagonism takes different forms in different periods. So it seems to me our job is, and we're near the end of this interview, so although you're going to get the last word, Christian, it seems to me our job is to try to maintain relations with the police that would prevent their complete identification with the most radical right. We have to have relations with them so they do not come to see the right as their comrades. So that if the left, for example, won an election, a plebiscite clearly favored by most people as a political force best able to reconstruct the economy and production in a time of crisis, it seems to me that the police could be kept out of the arms of the right and in favor of accepting a left in power, even if they didn't like most of our policies. It seems to me that's our goal, not to win the police to our side. That's not going to happen. There's always going to be conflict, but it doesn't have to lead to police identification with and complete support for the authoritarian or fascist state.
There's a lot in that to address. I'm going to try to focus on just a couple of points. One is how the right wing relates to the police, and different parts of the right do it differently and the right does it differently at different times. Like there is an element of right-wing ideology that is very law and order. And, you know, historically, the John Birch Society organized support your police rallies and that sort of thing. There's also an element of the far right that views the state hostily. And there's an element of antagonism on that side as well. So the relationship between the police and organized right-wing forces it's often going to depend on which right-wing forces. The relationship on the left to the police, I mean, I think you're right that we're not going to sort of win them over. In fact, I'm not even sure that that's a coherent notion. But I think we do have a need to sort of neutralize them in that conflict. And some of that, I think, will depend on maintaining and reinforcing constraints on police action, police autonomy, how much the police as an institution can set their own agenda. Some of that, I think, will depend on weakening the legitimacy of the institution overall, such that the police are not viewed in society generally as these sort of referees, but instead are seen as players in the game. And some of that, I think, will depend on, in fact, undermining the morale within the institution itself so as to encourage dissenting voices within policing, so as to encourage whistleblowing, so as to starve them of recruits, to make it really increase their sense of being sort of isolated and embattled, and therefore making it an unappealing place for people to go to. Now, on the one hand, I think the effect of that should be to decrease the overall strength of the police in society and to decrease their role in society overall so that it matters less what the people within the institution, what their policy preferences are. I guess I do have to admit, though, that that sort of political war of attrition may also make the elements of the right that are supportive of the police and that are appealing to them in terms of their own feelings of isolation and alienation and resentment, it may solidify the affinities that are already there. I think that's unfortunate for many reasons, but I think that it's ultimately more important that we diminish and dismantle the power of the police as the institution rather than that we steer it in more of a contained liberal democratic direction. And then we incur the cost of re-legitimizing it and reaffirming its position in society overall.
Yes, I think we sort of agree on that. I might put a little bit more emphasis on maintaining constitutionalism, but diminishing and dismantling is a good strategic sort of direction that has to happen. This enormous increase in policing and jails and the rest of it and the whole set of oppressive institutions. I think in the next installment, we can talk about that process to somehow corral the police is to diminish, dismantle, as well as create within the forces that remain some commitment to not participate in a martial law coup, who might even, in fact, resist the police who do want to join with the right and declare martial law. It seems to me that's also important. There's a whole number of things that could be done and a whole number of things that should be done with the left in terms of our response to the police and how we confront them. This was a good discussion, Christian. In the next installment, we'll be able to talk in much more detail about the way in which we can defang or limit the power of police and reduce the chances of a joint police authoritarian right force developing to, in fact, take control of the country. So thanks a lot for talking today. Fight.
Israeli word is an art that needs a scroll. After story had never been told, so now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up.
Most people recognize that 1978 Bob Marley and Peter Tosh song, Get Up, Stand Up. But KABU listeners also know it as the theme song for the show Voices from the Edge that Joanne Hardesty hosted for many years. Hardesty is a longtime community activist, KABU supporter, and the first African-American woman to take a seat on the Portland City Council. Field mole Desiree Helligers recorded excerpts from Wednesday night's celebration of Joanne Hardesty's swearing-in and also talked with activists about the significance of this electoral moment. The segment begins with MC Felisa Hagens, political director of the SEIU Local 49.
Joanne knows more than any other person knows that when you were the first, your obligation is to open every door and every window so you will never be the last. So, I would like to welcome our woman of the hour.
Recently, I heard DeRay McKinson of Black Lives Matters and Campaign Zero saying, hope is this notion that we believe our tomorrows can be better than our todays. And hope isn't magic. Hope is work. And you gotta fight for it. It was intentional for me to invite you to City Hall tonight because I like to call this the people's house. Some of you may have walked through this door for the very first time, but I certainly hope it won't be your last time. Some of you were with me in this building to testify on a secretly negotiated peace contract in October 2016. But here we are, two short years later, and now I'm your newest city commissioner. As commissioner-elect, I work with my council and with council's staff, security staff, and I want to give a huge thank you to Dorothy Elmore to reopen the balcony in council chambers this morning.
Thank you.
Now, no question, it was a symbolic gesture, to be sure. But my staff and I need to press for transparency and inclusion where it has been denied. The American Declaration of Independence informs us government exists to secure the rights of the people. Legislation must be based on the informed consent of those governed. Let's try to live up to those founding principles. As an organizer, of course, I believe in inclusion, broad-based community dialogue. As an activist, I believe in protesting injustice directly and with vigor. But I've been in this struggle for a while. I know tactics need to change when a movement makes gains. Some who have valued disruption will be challenged to find new roles as a new chapter of the inside game plays out. Make room for them. But as Dr. King encouraged, let's keep our eyes on the prize. As a veteran, I believe in the power of government to do good by its people and to share an equitable vision for all. As a Black woman, I know we have not lived up to our vision of who we want to be as a city, as a beloved community, and as a state. We face a legacy of complex interlinking problems. And to remedy them, we will have to work across governments, across jurisdictions, across bureaus. We will have to do it because it is in the best interest of the people of the city of Portland. I am the first African-American woman to serve on the Portland City Council. But together, we can open doors of opportunities regardless of race, gender, sexual orientation, language, culture, income, or ability level. I am convinced that our great diversity makes Portland rich. We simply must begin to be intentionally inclusive to reap the rewards of such richness. You and the community must figure out ways to stop thinking of unknown people as others. I ran with the theme of One Portland because when I went to every corner of this great city, I found so much more that we had in common than we had differences. Shall we prove for ourselves that we as individuals embrace diversity and find our common humanity together? We can do this, but we can only do it if this is not your last visit to City Hall. It touched my heart to walk into the City Council chamber today and see so many children, seeing parents bringing their children and their grandchildren. And what I want each of those young people to know is that this is not rocket science. You could sit on that podium. You could be a lawmaker. You could be the one making decisions that improves the lives of every Portlander in this community. I want you, if you hear nothing else today, hear that you've got the skills. All you need to do is get a little taller so you can So my assignments give me all the rest of our public safety system. Because some people forget that public safety covers a lot of areas, right? It is not just police, because we already know police won't solve the housing crisis or the mental health crisis or the lack of affordable housing and the lack of living wage employment opportunities. We already know that. But what we haven't done is invest in the rest of our public safety system. And I am looking forward to working with incredibly smart people to make sure that when we say we have a public safety system, what we're talking about is a system that keeps the public safe. I want to give a shout out to the fine men and women of the SCE Local 88, to the wonderful women and men that make up SCIU 49 and 503. I want to also say that this today, even though I'm the one in the seat, there were 500 of you who knocked on doors, made phone calls, through all kind of weather, and you did it for 18 months solid. There were 150 house parties that happened in every corner of this city. I was privileged to have one of my first votes today be about the open and accountable elections. Commissioner Amanda Fritz has been leading that effort. That system will help us ensure that we continue to have the most diverse people imaginable on the city council, and it will allow regular people like me to be able to have enough resources to run and serve in public office. Oh, you know, I gave shout-outs to ASME and SEIU, but I forgot about the fabulously wonderful Portland Firefighters Association, Local 43, and those fine firefighters showed up in their fabulous uniforms today. today. And let me tell you, as a fire chief, I will have my own jacket and hat. I don't know if the city's ready for it, but I'm ready. I'd like to thank Reverend Monterey for the fabulous food from Porsche's De La Soul. I want to thank Blues on Broadway for these beautiful blues that you see all over the place. I want to thank Rose City Sound for the AV. And so what I'm going to need you to do is to repeat these words after me. We the people of the city of Portland.
We the people of the city of Portland.
Believe that collective action.
Believe that collective action.
Accountability.
Accountability.
And transparency.
And transparency.
Are required to build a future.
Are required to build a future.
That is truly equitable for all people.
That is truly equitable for all people.
I recognize the importance of understanding.
I recognize the importance of understanding.
And appreciating our differences and similarities.
And appreciating our differences and similarities.
I pledge to make.
I pledge to make.
Improving Portland City Government.
Improving Portland City Government.
Accountability, transparency, and ethical integrity. A key personal priority.
A key personal priority.
Recognizing that democracy.
Recognizing that democracy.
Means rule by the people.
Means rule by the people.
We will work together.
We will work together.
To support our most vulnerable neighbors.
To support our most vulnerable neighbors.
Hold our elected leaders accountable.
Hold our elected leaders.
And build a city.
And build a city.
That our children will be proud to inherit.
That our children will be proud to inherit.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for coming out. Thank you for being a part of this historic event. And thank you for what you're going to do to make the city of Portland better for us all.
Lisa Higgins, political director at SEIU. Our members are incredibly excited to have an advocate for them on the city council, someone who's going to stand up for the janitors to clean City Hall, the security officers to secure City Hall, but not only those janitors and security officers, but the thousands of workers that we represent throughout the city of Portland. We're just thrilled to have a union champion in City Hall.
My name is Margaret Ann Jones. I'm just turned 70 this year, and I came out tonight because this is a historical time for Portland. For myself as a woman of color, coming out to see another woman of color that's going to be making or helping to govern, you know, Portland and helping to hopefully bring us together in some kind of way. That's my dream, because we're all in this together.
So Lisa Fay, you came out tonight to celebrate the election of Joanne Hardesty?
Of course, of course. She's really helped Brad to survive in the last couple years, get more organized and focused as a nonprofit and take us to the next level. And she was there in the early Dignity Village days and was a true champion of self-ran houseless community. Tiny house villages, we need one in every community because there's houseless people in every community. And we've learned that self-ran, self-governed tiny house communities have reduced crime levels in neighborhoods. They brought community together. She's a big supporter of having this happen, and we're hoping that city policy will change and we can move forward.
Yeah, and we'll see fewer people dying on the streets of one of the most livable cities in the U.S.
Oh, and there's no excuse. there is no excuse for another person to die this year on the streets because they didn't have a home.
I'm talking to Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive Radio.
I've seen a lot of firsts in my life, and this is a first that I wanted to be a part of, the first black city council as a woman. She's a people's council person because she protests with us. She's out there demonstrating with us. She comes to our meetings. She's out there dancing with us. She's celebrating. She consults people on how to do things, and she fights for people. She's out there in the public, and she's a public person. And then especially about police reform, and hopefully can help make the houseless community, which she's so involved with, a protected class, because all these houseless phobia, all these hate groups going around bashing up homeless people and kicking them off the land. The city is sweeping people. They criminalizing people just for existing and trying to coexist in the same place. But because they without houses, they without shower, they without laundry, they without garbage disposal, they're ridiculed. And I think Joanne will help the houseless advocacy group, or advocate, to address this ongoing problem in Portland, in Oregon, and in this country.
I'm Lori Palmer, and I'm the CEO and the founder of Go Get Your Child Community Violence Prevention Coalition. And I know they got the right person in that seat. Joanne is the one. We're going to set down history in Portland, Oregon, because now we got somebody from our community that's been fighting in our community with the people of the community that's in the house now. We're going to get some work done.
Greg Burrell. I'm the interim co-chair of the Multnomah County Democratic Party's Racial Inclusivity Work Group, and I serve on the Portland Association of Teachers Executive Board, as well as several other things for them. I'm here to celebrate Joanne. The teachers union endorsed her. We all campaigned for her. She came and met with teachers, so I know that she's very up on what we need for education in Portland.
Hi, I'm Jardima. I just want to celebrate her amazing win. We got her back all the way.
And what issues are you most invested in?
People experiencing houselessness, especially at this time of the year. First frost, it's not a joke. I'm really worried, very worried. Everywhere you go, you just can't get away from it. So we've got to come up with some solutions sooner rather than later, like right now.
Work on Joanne's campaign?
I did. Monica Beamer? Yes, I did. I helped with the house parties. It was a delight to meet all the people and to hear Joanne, and I always learned something new. I probably attended about 20 of them, and I am super excited to see all of that, those values and connections and the integrity, really, and the challenging of the status quo and the willingness to be like, this is not working, we need to do something different. Right, I work on the Homeless Bill of Rights with the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and we've worked together for a long time on that to end the criminalization of people who for simply being homeless, experiencing homelessness. Criminalizing people, ticketing them, harassing them, arresting them for things that people with houses do inside, sitting, sleeping, even eating. And this is happening across the country, growing. The number of laws is amazing. The ACLU of Oregon did a report. There's something like 250 laws in the 15 biggest cities in Oregon that criminalize people just for being homeless. So we need to create affordable housing. We need to create good jobs for folks, health care. I know that we'll work on that together. But yeah, we definitely need to be there working together. So
it's victory.
Well, I'm DJ Reggae Bob on KBOO. I came here tonight with a couple of my mentors here for this historic event. You know, this is just something that's never happened before. And Joanne's got our back. We've got Joanne's back. This is my friend Daryl Griffith, member of the community long time.
Yes, yeah, we got her back. We'll be there. Mayor next, then the governor.
Yeah. Well, it's happy Mayor New Year and happy City Council.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Monday Old Mole Variety Hour. You just heard the beginning of a song by Canadian singer-songwriter Bruce Cockburn and his 1987 song Waiting for a Miracle. I'm sorry we couldn't hear much of that, but it was written in Managua, Nicaragua, after observing the impact of years of the U.S.-created Contra Wars against the Sandinista government. At the time, he noted that since his first visit, quote, the revolution was getting tired, not hopeless, but tired. Back in the 1980s, the U.S. government and mainstream corporate media portrayed rebellions in Central America as communist-inspired to justify military interventions, in the case of Nicaragua, and support for brutal military regimes in the case of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Our next guest, James Phillips, reminds us of the legacy of those U.S. policies and how they continue in Nicaragua and Honduras. Phillips recently retired as affiliate professor of anthropology and international studies at Southern Oregon University. He has worked in and written about Central America since the 1970s, and acts as an expert witness in the asylum cases of Hondurans in U.S. immigration hearings. He has published many articles and book chapters on Central American immigrants and refugees, popular resistance movements, and the relationship of the U.S. to Central American countries, and is the author of the 2015 book, Honduras in Dangerous Times, Resistance and Resilience, and a recent piece that appeared in NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America, entitled Complicating the Narrative About Nicaragua. Welcome to KBOO, Jim.
Thank you.
So tell us what is missing in the current reporting on Nicaragua, which has been very critical of President Daniel Ortega.
Well, there's a lot to be critical of. I mean, Ortega is certainly not a perfect person, and his rule has not, in the past 2 years at least, has, you know, is open to criticism for sure. The issue, though, is that this latest conflict in Nicaragua, which began in April or so, which really flared up in April, is not simply one that the media has portrayed as a, you know, a brutal dictator and a very peaceful resistance movement trying to overthrow a brutal dictatorship. It's much more complicated than that, and most of the mainstream media has really not dealt with the complications of that at all. And by complications, I mean just a little bit of the history of the way in which the United States, for example, as one of the many actors in Nicaragua, has attempted over many, many years, since at least the 1980s, to overthrow, to deal with, to sideline, to destroy the Sandinista movement, and specifically Daniel Ortega, who's been one of the major figures that Washington has never liked. And the reason for that, of course, is because in the 1970s, the Sandinista movement and Ortega as part of it overthrew the 45-year dictatorship of the Somoza family, which the U.S. governments had supported, Democrats and Republicans, for many years, for 45 years. And I think that our people in Washington, our governments, the U.S. has never quite forgiven the Sandinistas or Ortega for, or the people of Nicaragua for that matter, for overthrowing a brutal dictatorship which we had supported.
And it's not just the mainstream corporate media that's been leaving out that the role of, or the longtime role of the U.S. in intervening in Nicaragua and Central America, but also human rights groups like Amnesty International left out important information about other factors that are leading to this kind of violence and the protests in Nicaragua.
Yeah, a lot of what's left out is any question about whether there are any other interests involved in the current conflict. That is, others, outsiders, or other Nicaraguan groups, perhaps, who are interested in their own agendas and furthering their own agendas in the current situation. There are students, of course, it was portrayed as a student-led movement to begin with. The current conflict that started in April and it was portrayed largely as a peaceful street movement. But there have for many years been organizations in Nicaragua, the Civic Youth Movement, funded by the National Democratic Institute, which is related to the National Endowment for Democracy. All of these are funded and related to the United States government and in part to the CIA. There's a history between the National Endowment for Democracy and the CIA. And as we can see and say, not only in Nicaragua itself during the 1980s, during the Nicaraguan Revolution, but in many other countries, Guatemala, Chile, even Jamaica, has been involved in, shall we say, regime change against governments that it didn't like, that we didn't like. And so there's that. There's the U.S. involvement itself, and it's been there for many years. And it's always phrased as promoting democracy in Nicaragua. The question is, what do we mean by democracy? Does that mean, do we want regime change or what? Then there are other issues as well. A lot of, quite a few people that I've talked to when I was there during the past year talk about opposition in other forms, organized gangs who've come from El Salvador. Nicaragua is the only Central American country which does not have, at this time, a serious drug problem or a serious gang problem. In part because of the way that the Sandinista police have, the government police have dealt with these things in a community-oriented way. But the organized crime, drugs and narcos related in Guatemala, Honduras in particular, and El Salvador may well have an interest in penetrating that and getting into Nicaragua. I should point out, so there's that. There's organized criminal activity that some of the observers that I've talked to seem to see. There are also, these demonstrations were not as nearly as peaceful as some of the... The mainstream media has always pointed out that, it keeps saying that the government, the police, the Nicaraguan police, and the government has used all the violence against peaceful demonstrators. The reality is that these peaceful demonstrators are mixed up a great deal with non-peaceful demonstrators, with gang protesters, with others who have their own interests in mind. There's been a lot of talk about the way that people have been killed, including Sandinista officials and all as well. So that part of the story doesn't get told.
And there's also the question of student involvement in the conflict, which is more complex. Not all students, yeah. Not all young people are protesting against the Sandinistas, or at least for the reasons that the National Endowment for the for Democracy and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio would like to think.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of, some of these students have been, this is Nicaragua. Nicaragua is different from the rest of Central America in some ways, partly, largely because of the revolution of the 1970s and early 80s and what they went through with the Contra War in the 1980s. There's a great deal of, the young people in Nicaragua have been well trained in the question of resistance to any kind of dictatorship and repression. So the Nicaraguan people themselves, the Sandinistas and all, have trained their own youth, their own students, their own people, these generations, to resist these things. And so it's natural that if they see problems with the Nicaraguan government, with Ortega and sort of a heavy-handed dictatorship there, that they would resist that. The problem, though, is that this kind of resistance, which in itself is what people do and should do to promote democracy, is also co-opted by the United States and by outside interests for their own purposes, which are mostly non-democratic.
And there's always been a high level of hypocrisy in U.S. policy around the world, but especially directed at Latin America, where figures like Ortega or Lula in Brazil or Maduro in Venezuela, who, although flawed and problematic, are all branded as dictators violating human rights, when at the same time, the U.S. repeatedly supports actual brutal dictators and anti-democratic military regimes, such as in Honduras. What's with this double standard?
Well, I do a lot of work in Honduras, and that's one of the places that I'm currently involved with, you know, working and studying what happens in Honduras, and I've been doing that for many years. Today in Honduras, we actually do have a brutal dictatorship. Washington has accused Ortega in Nicaragua of getting himself reelected illegally in the last elections that were held. Well, that happened in Honduras a year later, last year, actually, in a much more brutal way, a much more violent way, actually. And the U.S. Congress and members of our own administration, the State Department, said, wonderful, that's a great democracy at work in Honduras, which has a death, a murder rate somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 per 100,000 people. Nicaragua's murder rate under the Sandinista government has been somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 per 100,000, the lowest in the area in the region by far, one of the lowest ones in the hemisphere. So it's a much more peaceful country until these demonstrations occurred. There's a whole list of things about Nicaragua that we could say that people don't know, that under the Sandinista government have been great improvements in a lot of ways in the lives of people in Nicaragua, including the use, for example, of sustainable energy. They've become a leader in the hemisphere, actually, in that. We don't hear about that very much. This is not to say that, you know, that Ortega should be, that we should all support Daniel Ortega. This is not for the United States to decide, or for me to decide, or for us to decide. It's for the people of Nicaragua to decide who they want. The problem is that it is extremely complicated. There are many different factions in Nicaragua. We need to understand that.
And also that the U.S. was involved in the coup in Honduras during the Obama administration. And let's turn to that. You know, you draw this important comparison between Nicaragua and surrounding countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, which are suffering extreme levels of violence. And, of course, that violence originates in U.S. interventions in the 70s and 80s. But let's talk a bit about Honduras before we run out of time here. And since Hondurans make up the majority of migrants making up the caravan seeking asylum at the U.S. border, what is behind the high numbers of Hondurans fleeing that country?
Well, there's a history of our using Honduras as our base, you know, to control the rest of Central America. That goes way back again to at least the 1980s, 1970s, really. We used, in fact, Honduras was the base from which we engineered the coup d'etat in Guatemala in 1954, which led to many years of genocide in that country. Honduras has always been that base. But what's happened more recently, in 2009, there was a coup d'etat that overthrew a democratically elected president. And that coup d'etat, which was certainly illegal and unconstitutional in the Honduran context, has led to a series of governments that now, the current government is, Hondurans call it a dictatorship. It has reelected itself illegally twice now. And there's a lot of concern about that. But the real issue in Honduras today, and the major reason why people flee this country, is because they're displaced. And they're displaced for two reasons. One is poverty, and the other is violence. And all of that stems in large part from the models of development, economic development, in a country like Honduras, which is rich in minerals. We have American, U.S. companies, Canadian companies, and European companies, and the Chinese, who are extracting hundreds of thousands of tons of all kinds of ores, antimony, iron ore, gold, etc., from Honduras, a country rich in these minerals. And what all of that does is all these things are done with the blessing of the Honduran government, ignoring all the rights of local communities. And so local communities are displaced because mining and logging and tourism and all these industries displace communities. They destroy environments. They don't observe, they don't need to observe any rules or regulations. They don't need to get permission from anybody, from any of the local people, which they're supposed to do according to the law. And all of that displaces communities, creates unemployment, uproots people, and contributes to poverty. Honduras is now considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, even ahead of Haiti. So poverty alone, and when people are poor, their right, human rights, are often denied and ignored. We know that even in our own country. So that has led and fed to the poverty is fed gang violence and a bunch of other things. On top of which, there's a great deal of corruption in the Honduran government, and that's been documented again and again and again. I won't go into the details of that. So a combination of a corrupt government, an illegal government, an oppressive government, poverty and violence are enough to push people to leave the country. They can't survive in its conditions anymore.
And that is such an important piece missing from all of the media coverage and human rights organizations' accounts about what is happening in Honduras Nicaragua. James Phillips, thank you so much for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour today. And we need to have you return at some point in the future to continue this discussion about U.S. policy.
Be happy to.
And in thank Honduras you. And Nicaragua and the violence that is pushing so many people to migrate.
Be glad to do that. Thank you.
Well, this concludes this week's Old Mole Variety Hour, and I want to thank guests Christian Williams, James Phillips, and Joanne Hardesty, and the Old Moles, Desiree Helligers and Bill Resnick, and engineer Patricia Kohlberg. You can listen again to and share with others today's Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to topics discussed, including a link to James Phillips' NACLA piece on the more complicated narrative about Central America. You can also make your New Year's donation to KBOO and support community radio. Next week on The Old Mole, Denise Morris and Victoria Saucedo review the film Roma, directed by Alfonso Cuarón. Roma is currently playing at the Hollywood Theater in Northeast Portland and includes a 7.1 surround sound viewing experience you don't want to miss. We'll also hear the third part of Bill Resnick's discussion with Christian Williams about the political need to demilitarize the police. Coming up on this morning's KBOO lineup at 10 o'clock on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to the Sightline Institute about the fight to stop fossil fuel infrastructure. At 11, Making Contact looks at wealth inequity and the prospects of creating a universal basic income. And at 11:30, Madness Radio explores voices and visions from outside mental health.